I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Alex Hawley is the new face of fiction. The Penguin Random House Showcase for a first-time novelist has tapped her book, All True, Not a Lie in It, as the 2015 selection. She joins me now to talk about her book about Daniel Boone, told in his voice, which, like the man himself, is replete with tall tales, myth-making, and adventure. The book gives us the life of Boone from his childhood through to his attempt to settle Kentucky and his capture by the Shawnee. I'll be interested to know what Dr. Hawley found so compelling about Boone, these times that Boone lived in, and what we might find contemporary in this story several hundred years away from the present day. Alex Hawley studied English literature and creative writing at Oxford University and the University of East Anglia and the University of British Columbia. Her first book, a short story collection, The Old Familiar, was published in 2008. She won the 2014 Canada Writers Bloodlines competition and was a runner-up for the CBC Literary Award for short stories in 2012 and 2014. She lives in Kelowna, where she teaches at Okanagan College. AlexHawley.com is the website for more. The book is published by Knopf. Please welcome to the Plant Online program in Vancouver last week for appearances for this book, Alex Hawley. Dr. Hawley, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, and please call me Alex.
You've studied writing and literature, as I said in the introduction. So does it go back, say, a long time, say when you were a kid, that you wanted to write?
Yes, I think writing's always been my main goal in life. I used to hassle my mom into writing down stories for me before I could do it for myself, and she still has a stack of those somewhere. So, yeah, that's always been my way of expressing myself, always been something I wanted to do, and I feel really lucky now to be able to teach in my field and to have some books out.
What's it like because you've obviously studied writing, as you have,
yeah.
To study it for as long as you have, and have that desire, say, from an early age. Were there times when you're reading someone else's work that you think, I don't know if I can do this myself?
Of course, especially studying the literary side of things. I did my PhD in sort of the academic side of literature. And I focused on Virginia Woolf, and I would sort of despair at ever being able to do what she did. But at the same time, studying literature that way gives you such an array of models and such good ideas. Once you learn how to read like a writer, then you can sort of figure out what they've done, what kind of patterns they've come up with, how they've knitted their stories and characters together. And it gives you some tools and some patterns to practice with. For instance, Woolf talked about tunneling, she called it, which was creating the past for her characters. She would just picture a person and then tunnel her way back into that character's past to make him or her rounded and real. And that was something I had to learn how to do, and I think I learned how to do from her. It took a long time.
Yeah, and so when you sit down to write your own stuff, I'm sure this isn't the first attempt at a novel that you've tried.
Right, and actually this very novel took three complete rewrites, not just sort of redrafting, but throw it out and start again. So it's taken me quite a while. The first time I wrote it sort of like an A.S. Byatt possession story, where you have a researcher on the trail of Daniel Boone, and it really didn't work, and my agent told me so, and I had to accept that she was right after sulking for a couple of days. And then she said, no, you're too far away from it. You need to get to the subject, get to Daniel Boone. So I threw that out, started again with a third-person account of Daniel Boone. So it was all, he did this, and he went here. And it still didn't feel right. It felt more like an attempt at a biography, which was not what I wanted to do. And so eventually I had to throw that one out, too, and go for the first person, the I, which I was a little dubious about. I mean, taking on the voice of a famous historical male character was a big jump, but I think in the end it worked. It was the right voice.
So how did you get to Boone, and I guess what fascinated you about him that he became the subject of this book, this novel?
Right. It doesn't make a lot of surface sense, does it? I mean, I'm Canadian, female, vegetarian, peaceable. I like beds. I don't like camping. And he's the exact opposite. But I think it's just sort of the almost incredible nature of his story that it almost feels like somebody made it up. Mm-hmm. And parts of it have been made up because the historical record is fairly patchy. But yeah, it's a family story. It's a love story. It's a great adventure. It has historical sweep. And so when I started thinking about what I wanted to write about next after my short stories, I suddenly remembered reading about him in National Geographic when I was about 10. And so I asked the library at Okanagan College to dig that issue out of the stacks for me, which they obligingly did, and which I have not yet returned. And when I read that article again, I thought, wow, has anyone written about him lately? And it seemed to be no. So I thought, okay, I'm going to do this. And I felt very lucky to be able to give it a try.
What does one need to know about Boone as we start reading this book?
I don't think you have to know a huge amount about him, because especially younger readers now in their 20s and maybe 30s haven't necessarily even heard of Boone. Mm-hmm. But I think perhaps all you need to know to start with was that he was a famous hero of the American frontier, and perhaps most famous for opening up a passage into the West for white settlement of what was then Shawnee and Cherokee and Delaware Territory. And I think if you've got that in mind, you can pick up a lot from the novel.
And why fiction for you in the course of writing this book? I mean, is there a place where history ends and your novel begins, say?
Well, as I said, there are quite a lot of gaps in history, and that was pretty scary for me as a novelist to think, how much am I allowed to make up here? How much can I do? And I tried to stick broadly to the known events of his life. I had to elide or push together some events. I mean, he went to Kentucky several times, and I've made it into one big trip just in the context of the novel. But I again had to give myself the freedom to be a novelist, right, to be creative. And I think anyone who writes historical fiction has to do that. We don't know what these people were thinking. We don't know what they were saying, and we're putting voices in their mouths, literally. So I think you have to be okay with that, and you have to give yourself that permission. Once you get over that bump, then the book starts to really work.
And is it easier because he's several hundred years away? I mean, if you had to write about someone who's alive, that'd probably be, I don't know, would it be a greater challenge than, say, someone like Boone?
For me, that would be a lot harder. I think I'd be a lot more nervous writing about someone who is still around. And I've always been really interested in writing about the past. My literary interests have always been, 19th century and before that. And my writing interest, too, has tended that way. When I write short stories, they tend to be more contemporary, but they don't tend to be about real people. So, when it came to writing the big narrative, I was pretty happy that my character was somebody in the past and someone that there were a lot of sources about.
So what's life like in 1799? I'm curious to know what interests you about that time period.
It's funny because, again, that was never really my period to start with. I was very much the Victorianist, the ladies in London with their crinolines and tea parties and so on. That was kind of my thing. So this is very different. It's very, very rough on the frontier, especially as the settlers start moving westward. Living in thrown together cabins, practically starving at some points, living on nothing but meat because they can't get crops planted. They can't preserve the meat because they don't have enough salt. Their clothes are falling to pieces. They're dirty and smelly, and I tried to conjure those parts up, as well as conjuring up some of the finer details of life, how clothes were made, what people's hair would have looked like. So it's a bit of a juggling act because you want it to feel realistically historical without it banging readers over the head with, here is another detail about 18th century life. So I tried to do that pretty lightly, but I love doing the research. I love that.
Yeah, and so do you get a sense of what motivated Boone, what drove him?
My sense, and I talk about this in the foreword to the book, is that he was constantly trying to find somewhere new, a new paradise, every year or so. And because America at the time, it wasn't even America yet, it was still the colonies when the book starts, the British colonies, because it was still seen as so vast and so open to settlement, at least in the Europeans' minds, he was one of the people who just kept doing that. Like, let's just move on, let's keep going, let's see what's out there. And that became the motivation for him in my book. And it's a very destructive motivation because it leads to extreme trouble for not just him, but for his family, too. And that's kind of the crux of the conflict in the book.
And do you think his relationship with Indians that can be of interest to us in a contemporary context?
I think so, and I hoped so. And I was so dumbfounded by the historical facts of what happened. And in the second part of my book, after encroaching on territory that had not been agreed to in any sort of treaty or mm-hmm. deal with the First Nations tribes, he's captured and taken into the Shawnee tribe and to live with them in their town of Chillicothe, the winter town where they stayed. And they actually adopt him, which was so unbelievably generous and fascinating to me. And I think just those entirely different world views of the First Nations people at the time and then the white settlers' intent on expansion at the time is still something that is reverberating today and is still something we need to think about today. Those different world views, how do we reconcile them, and what did European settlement do? What did contact do to the people who were here in the first place?
And so what was their relationship like? I mean, he was captured by them, and then, as you just said, he was adopted by them.
Yes.
What do you think brought them together eventually?
In my take, it does, and it's almost incredible to me. It's astounding that what was a fairly common practice among the Shawnee and certain other tribes was to adopt captives to replace their lost warriors. And so Daniel actually became the chief's son and was seen as the embodiment of the dead son that he had lost. So just so different from the European view at the time. And I think it's a view that Daniel was very impressed by. I think if he'd had it his way, he would have carried on in that life.
What I've read of the book so far describes these places that he encounters. Did you go to these places yourself in the course of writing this book?
You know, I would have absolutely loved to. I was too pregnant, and I couldn't get insurance. I had all these plans. I had it all mapped out, my trip to Pennsylvania and Tennessee and Kentucky, and we were going to drive here and there, and the insurance company said, no, you're not. And it was a good thing because my son was actually born early. So I had to imagine it. I looked at some pictures and some videos online and lots of books and just had to create it for myself. I think as any novelist does, you have to create your own world and be able to see it your way. And so that was a pretty big struggle because it would have been nice to have some real-life experience to draw on, but that's how I did it.
And a lot of these places, I mean, do they still look the same? I mean, do they look as they did in Boone's time?
Some do, and there's still the Daniel Boone Wilderness Trail that you can follow, and part of that is highways now. But, there's still forest, national parks. There's the Boone birthplace home that you can go and see, and the house where his son lived you can go and see as well in Missouri. So some of the sites are still there, and that's pretty wonderful to me because so much has been lost. So the fact that some of these places have been preserved is amazing.
Yeah. Were there folk heroes in the Canadian context, in Canadian history, like Boone?
I'm sure there were. I'm thinking of explorers that we used to learn about in about grade five or six, Champlain and Lewis and Clark and so on, who were partly in Canada, and Cabot and so on. There are lots of amazing Canadian stories, too, and I've kind of got the pioneer bug now. I might end up going back to some of those stories. I'm actually thinking about a Kelowna settler, Father Pandozzi, who was a Jesuit missionary in the Kelowna area where I'm from, and his story is pretty interesting, too, and his interaction with the first people there is quite a tale, so that might be something to work on later.
What era is he from?
He's 19th century.
I see. Yeah.
Yes. and, a little later.
Yeah, and so this book, All True, Not a Lie in It, it gives us, I guess, half of Boone's life, is that right?
That's right. He's about 45 when this one ends.
And so I'm sure people ask if you'll continue writing about him, will you?
Yes, I will. I'm working on a sequel right now. My editor wanted this one to end at kind of a tense point, and so that's why it ends the way it does. And there's so much more of his story. He lived to be a pretty old man, and lots of wild and poignant and hair-raising things happened to him after this story ends, so I'm happy to be carrying on with that.
What's it like to be the new face of fiction? I mean, you have written, you've published, I should say, a collection of short stories previously, but this being your first novel and then being part of this program, I mean, we look at the list of people who've gone before, and it's a quite a remarkable list of folks.
Right.
For you, as a first-time novelist, I mean, that must be pretty cool, is it?
It's very cool, and I feel really, really lucky to have been chosen and to have such a great group of editors, from Amanda Lewis, who picked it up out of the pile, to my editor, Ann Collins, who helped me comb it all out. So, I do feel extraordinarily lucky, and it feels like, really being a writer, because you don't really get handed a badge in this job saying you're now officially a writer. So that made it feel like a badge. It made it feel pretty good, even though I'm sort of rapidly heading towards being the middle-aged face of fiction instead of the new one. It's still really nice.
What did you learn about writing after writing a novel as you have for say, the first time? I mean, has this process changed your writing at all?
One big thing I did is I wrote this novel longhand, which was quite a revelation. I found it, it's hard on the hand, but it was easier on the brain. I found that the little editor wasn't sitting on my shoulder quite so much as he is when I'm working on the computer. So I think I'm going to carry on with that. That's what I've been doing so far with the sequel. It somehow connects you to the story more physically, and maybe that wakes up something in the mind. So that was one revelation. Also, just the fact that it's okay to make a big mess when you're writing. If you have to write it and throw it out three times, well, that's okay. That's part of the process. That's how I seem to work, so I can accept that now.
How did you come to write longhand? Was that something that you consciously thought of, or is it something you stumbled on?
Something I stumbled on, really, and I used to do it all the time as an undergrad. I wrote most of my essay drafts longhand before I would go and type them up, and I think that those essays were a lot better than the ones I did in grad school. I think I thought them through a little bit more, and just that extra step seems to have winnowed out some of the problems that you don't always catch when you're typing. So I'm very glad that I decided to do that. I think it really helped.
And are there certain rituals involved with that? I mean, is there certain paper? Is there certain pens?
I'm a little fussy about the notebooks I use. I like a certain size of paper, and I like the ruled paper. I like spiral bound. I like I don't like the ink pens that just keep on flowing. I like a good ballpoint that doesn't skip or bump or scratch. So like most writers, I'm a little bit of a fusspot about that stuff.
And you type your own stuff later?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, because that's when a lot of the editing happens. And I think that's a good step to be able to break it up from the longhand into the typing. I think that's a really good editing step.
What do you hope readers will get from this book? And I mean, it's a chance to learn about Boone, to get to know him a bit better. Is that something that you're thinking of, say, when talking about the book and trying to get people to pick it up?
Sure. I would hope they would get to know this historical figure a little better, at least my rendering of him. And I would hope that maybe they would understand what it's like to want something so desperately that you will risk everything to get it, as Daniel does.
Yeah, he's a fascinating figure that I'm a big fan of American history, and have started looking at this era. And he's someone that I didn't know much about, and I thought to myself, well, maybe I should pick up, say, a nonfiction book on him. But I think this is a great way to get to know him, because you get a sense of who he might actually be.
Right, and it's my version, as I've said. But a few people who've read early copies have told me I enjoyed reading about him, and then I went and found a biography to learn more. And I would hope people might do that. I think that's a very nice way to go about it. I would feel very fortunate if people took my book as a first step to learning more.
You mentioned you encountered Boone for the first time by seeing him in that National Geographic, was it?
Yes.
How old were you again?
I think I was 10, or 9 or 10. Yeah, it's 1985, that issue, I believe.
Yeah, so, I mean, it is funny how things at an early age like that affect us.
Right, I can't really remember what it was that grabbed me so much as a kid about that. I remember looking at it at school and in the library at my elementary school, and it was the image, I think, of Boone holding his son's body that really grabbed me, and it's hard to say why it did, but it grabbed me enough that it was still imprinted on my mind when it came back to me a few years ago.
Yeah, and it's funny, if you look at a magazine today or any sort of piece of art or photograph, and then you could look at it for hours, it's not going to have the same effect years later. That's something when you're such a young age, I mean, at a formative age.
Yes, and those things that almost cement themselves to your mind when you're a kid and then hit you later, it's quite intriguing to figure out the path they take.
Alex, this is a great achievement. Congratulations on it, and good luck with it.
Thank you so much. It's been great to speak with you.
The same.
Thanks.
AlexHawley.com is the website for more. The book is called All True, Not a Lie in It. It's published by Knopf. Its author, Alex Hawley, joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.